Welcome to Shift Shapers, where we are shaping the shift as we transition from the predictable world of, hey, that grocery truck's going to show up whenever I want it to, and everything is good. The power grid's going to be just nicely intact, and the world as we know it is going to continue to be the world as we know it, and shifting into, hey, you know what? Maybe we better get to know our neighbors and start building a community where we can rely on each other in the event that things become unpredictable. So in that spirit, you know, and in that realm of things, I couldn't help but invite the astrologer Richard Nolley, who I have on the phone with me, who is a professional astrologer since 1973, which is the same year that I came to California from Western New York. I'm sure there was a planetary alignment then because it was a big shift in my life. Richard Nolley has also been an author on astrological subjects since 1975 and is the proprietor, shall we say, of a website called AstroPro. Good morning and good afternoon. Buenas tardes, Richard Nolley.
Well, hi, Daniel, and hello to all your listeners.
And one of the things that got me fascinated with what you're doing and what you're predicting is, now I know people come to an astrologer for various types of predictions, advice based on what patterns are clear when we foresee alignments of different kinds with the planets, when we see alignments of different kinds with constellations, and that there are some things that astrologers have come to see as predictable. What fascinated me is, I've had my chart done, you know, I'm Libra, I have, you know, the moon in Taurus, I've got the Leo rising, so I've got all these things that I can say, oh yeah, that's because I have Leo rising, you know, and I can play with it, okay? I'm not someone who really, like, gets in there and does the grind and looks at the little pieces and with the mortar and the pestle, and you are. And what you've been able to do is take a look at, hey, you know what, here's something that happens on the Earth on a global level when planets and align in certain ways. Like what I'm getting is that just these celestial spheres around us, Jupiter and Mercury, the Moon, the Sun, when they have alignments and eclipses of different kinds, man, stuff happens. I mean, stuff happens on the Earth and in the Earth's crust even. And I was looking at, I've been about 6 months studying your work, going back to the AstroPro site, and then going to looking around and Googling up different earthquake and volcano events and things like that. And what I've come to see and agree with in your predictions, for instance, for 2011 on AstroPro.com, is that, man, when we've had three eclipses, two solar and one lunar, and I guess there are three supermoons this year, and you've been predicting there will be shakeups and events of various kinds on the Earth. So can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, the notion that earthquakes and volcanic eruptions, major significant ones, I should qualify, because there are earthquakes and volcanic eruptions every day if you take the planet as a whole, but the big headline-making earthquakes and volcanic eruptions, those are concentrated around the time of eclipses of the sun and moon, and also what I have christened as a supermoon, which is a newer full moon happening when the moon is in its closest approach to Earth. And you may recall back in March, there was a supermoon that, according to the mass media, was the only supermoon of the year, and something that was supposed to bring havoc and destruction worldwide. And I got on the radio and television interviews as much as I could to try and correct that misimpression. Supermoons happen like eclipses 4 to 6 times a year. Mm-hmm. And that particular supermoon back in March on the 19th, it was the closest one in a number of years, but it's just another supermoon, and there will be three more this fall. So supermoons and eclipses, and by the way, the dates of the supermoons and eclipses, they're all in my 2011 World Forecast, which is online free at my website, astropro.com. But yeah, I followed these things for a very long time, right. And I'm obviously not the first, because the Greek historian Thucydides remarked in the years BCE that, in fact, there was a major volcanic eruption that was connected with an eclipse. And then in terms of supermoons, well, there's Mount Pinatubo, there was the Galveston hurricane, because these things are also connected with storms. The earthquake that just rocked Christchurch, New Zealand,
yes,
back in February, that was the strongest earthquake to hit that country since the time of the, I think it was February 8, 1931, which was another supermoon. And those are the two biggest earthquakes ever to hit New Zealand, and they're both supermoons. So
wow,
these things certainly work historically.
Right. And so if I'm hearing you, you're saying, okay, it isn't necessarily like the sky is falling. Like you're discouraging a Chicken Little approach, but you are not taking the gloves off either. Like you're not like putting on light kid gloves or something, or sterile gloves to like handle this subject. You're saying on your site to be expecting and be ready, like you're saying carpe diem, and be ready here. There's some stuff coming.
Absolutely, and I say be ready for the things that you can capitalize on and the things that you need to sort of shelter from.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I've been advising in my world forecasts for 6-7 years now, hey, go buy gold every time it dips if you want to have something that will stand you in good stead in future. And gold just hit a record high again, I guess it was yesterday or this morning. When I started advising people to do that, gold was $375 an ounce, and now it's about $1,600.
Yeah, it's gone up
quite
a bit.
There's positive things you can do, and then in terms of preparing for the negatives, absolutely recognize that the infrastructure can collapse for a period of time. Just look back at Hurricane Katrina and what that did to New Orleans. So we've got to have our dry goods and our batteries and our flashlights and our water and our full tank of gas and all those things. And also, as you've been saying, get with your neighbors, because this is not something that an individual can survive and prosper alone. It's not even a family. It's got to be a certain amount of community.
And that's really proven out in areas like in Japan. They're really the only hope there. In the northern part of Japan, where the tsunami hit, and all of the hazards and predictable death from the meltdown of the nuclear plant, is the only hope really there is that the communities recongregate in a safe places, gradually re-energize themselves as communities, and it's like the government of Japan has been rocked just like Fukushima was. That one speaker, Richard Heinberg, who is has a lot, written a number of books about peak oil, he predicts that Japan will recover from the quake and the tsunami and the meltdown, but they will adjust, but they'll never recover.
Well, look what's happened in New Orleans. I think that's a fair analogy. That city has not been the same, and it will be generations getting back to where it was before the hurricane hit. We tend to, as humans, look on these natural disasters as something that our governments can and should handle for us, because our governments are essentially the religion or the gods of the present-day culture, in the sense that we look to them as being the greatest power, able to handle any kind of an emergency. They're not. They're hopeless when it comes to the forces of nature.
And the forces of nature can be very, it doesn't have to, I've seen portions of this film about 2012. It was a really spectacular techno-destructo film.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, not very predictive about anything, but really great use of special effects with giant seawalls coming in over Manhattan and stuff. But when you think about it, to do a lot of damage, it doesn't take much. That tsunami was not big. In terms of size, it was pretty high. I mean, it was big in that sense, that it was able to do a lot of destruction in the space of a minute. But it didn't. It wasn't like this 100-foot wall of water that hit the entire Japanese, string of islands. It was just this one isolated part. Like it was maybe a couple of miles wide, at the most. And yet the destruction and damage that it caused, and the death in a very short time, that the country now has to cope with, it doesn't really take much. I mean, you don't have to be totally destroyed to be in many ways devastated by
it. Yeah, you can have a local event like that because of the interconnection economically and culturally and socially. If you get one region that is severely damaged, it drags down a whole country. And look at what happened to Japan. In fact, it dragged down the global economy. The interruption in production,
yes,
let alone, you know, the loss of life and all that destruction. But just look at what happened to the world economy when Japanese production essentially shut down for only 3 weeks, a month, and then it was, you know, not up to full speed. The U.S. and the world economy were growing at 3 to 4%, according to the best estimates, right about until March the 12th. And from there on out, the growth rate dropped to 1 or 1.1%. It was cut two-thirds.
Now,
so just a small little place,
yes,
that suffered. Yeah, it was a disaster, but the effect was global.
And the effect was global. That's right. I remember hearing about that there were factories that couldn't get orders for technical parts because Japan wasn't able to get them out. And that affected, that had a big ripple effect. Now, what I've gone to is another website. It's not yours. It's someone else's. And it's kind of like a, you know, get ready for you know, 2012, December 21st. Very interesting information about it. Whether or not you think that there's going to be a cataclysmic end of the world in 2012, or that there's a unique alignment of planets and galaxy and nothing more, is okay. But what's really interesting and illustrative of this particular part of this site, it's called poleshift2011.com, is that there's a page devoted to Earth, what is called Earth Change Events, and it's really instructive to look at what happened around the supermoon and around these eclipses. There's a whole list. I mean, we're just talking vaguely about it, but here's a few. Hundreds of dead fish surface in Glen Ellen Pond, Chicago. Thousands of dead fish wash up on Western Australia coast. 6.5 quake hits off Indonesian coast. Massive 8.9, of course, quake hits Japan. Three volcanoes erupt almost at the same time after Japan earthquake. The hundreds of Burmese fishermen missing after fierce storms, and there's like a Tonga gets a 6.1 magnitude quake. I mean, it goes on and on and on. There's Vanuatu. There's an earthquake in or a volcano, like during the this last eclipse, and not Somalia but Ethiopia, a volcano erupted that has never erupted in human history, and. That's
I remember
in the list
that
here too.
One. The U.S. Secretary of State Clinton had to change her travel plans because of the ash cloud from the volcano, the Rift Valley in Africa. I mean, you know, apart from the changes in air travel due to the ash from the volcanic eruption in Chile.
And that was another. The volcanic eruption in Chile was another really huge one. Sure. And there was, and also put. Puyehue, I think, is the name of it. There's a volcano in Chile that went off. It was the eclipse, the lunar eclipse, prior to this last solar eclipse. This volcano went off in Chile, stopped air traffic. In fact, it was stopping air traffic all the way to across, the, like in Hawaii, I think they were even having some problems.
Yeah.
And it was at, it was like this volcano that just wouldn't quit. I mean, it was having not only ash but lava. And this was right after, I think, the second eclipse, and you were predicting this one's going to hit, and it was right where you said, where the line of the shock line is. So can you explain a little bit about where did this come from, this predictability that you're seeing?
Well, Claudius Ptolemy, the father of Western astrology, had noted, he wrote in the second century, the Common Era, that the moon was and other planets were particularly important when they were what he called swift in course. Well, swift in course means when they're moving fast.
Mm.
And the moon moves at its fastest, i.e. is swiftest in course, when it's closest to Earth. It's like watching a ship far away or seeing a boat right up on shore. The ship far away seems to hardly move at all, whereas the boat along shore seems to be moving very fast. And so when the moon is closest to Earth, which is when it's at perigee, it's moving very fast. And so that was a hint from way back in the second century that astrologers then were noticing what I've come to call a supermoon, which is when the moon is near full and closest to Earth. So this kind of stuff goes back centuries. And then I started researching it and going back centuries, and I found huge connections between the supermoon and things like volcanic eruptions and earthquakes and big storms. I mentioned, for example, the Galveston hurricane, which still ranks as the deadliest natural disaster in U.S. history. That struck on a supermoon, and the Mount Pinatubo volcanic eruption, that was the biggest volcanic eruption in the late 20th century. That was a supermoon. And then Hurricane Katrina actually formed in the Gulf on a supermoon.
And of course, the Midwest, the Midwest of the United States, all this year. I mean, when has it not been floating on a flood or submerged under a flood? I'm looking back, and I'm not sure when actually the flooding started, but I think it's just a continuation of flooding from last year, unfortunately. But also the amount of time that that region has spent underwater. So much of it, if I look at it, I would bet a dollar on, you know, a dollar against a dime that I'd go back there to see when the worst of this flooding started, and it would coincide. I'm sure I'd start seeing some coincidence there with that.
Well,
with some
there are longer-term cycles, too. I mean, a supermoon comes and goes on a particular night, and I look at them as having about a typically three-day either way sphere of influence or effectiveness. I call it the geocosmic shock window.
Right.
But there are other far longer-term cycles that relate to storms and geophysical activity, such as earthquakes and volcanic eruptions. One of them is the moon's declination cycle. And by that I mean how far the moon is above or below Earth's equator during the course of an orbit around the Earth.
Uh-huh.
And the moon has extremes. And the where it reaches a maximum declination, gets very far north or south of the celestial equator some years, and then roughly on an 18.6-year cycle, there are years where it's closer to the equator. It's not as big a torque on the planet Earth. Well, we hit a peak in about 2005 or 6, and it's remaining above normal until about 2014. So we're still in this cycle of high storms and high geophysical activity for a few more years yet. And you can go back to, I think it was the 1931 Los Angeles or Long Beach earthquake, which was the deadliest one in the first half of the 20th century. That was during a lunar peak of declination cycle.
Okay, so there's not only the perigee and the moon being close, but there's also where it... Now, when you say the celestial equator, do you mean the equator of the galaxy as well as the Earth's equator, or
actually,
how do we distinguish that?
Yeah, the galactic equator is a different thing from the celestial equator.
Okay.
The celestial equator is Earth's equator projected out into space.
Oh, okay.
And that's the system of coordinates that astronomers use. They use right ascension and declination. So they have declination to measure north or south, and right ascension to measure distance along the celestial equator, which is Earth's equator, projected out into space.
Okay.
So astrology uses those things, and mostly we use what's called the ecliptic longitude and latitude. And the longitude, the ecliptic is the path where eclipses take place. It's
mm-hmm.
Earth's orbit around the sun projected out into space, and then latitude is measured north and south from there. So there's lots of different coordinate systems, and most astrologers only use one.
Mm. And these eclipses this year, the solar eclipses particularly, were visible only either from the Arctic Circle or the Antarctic.
And that happens whenever you begin what's called a new Saros cycle. And Saros cycles were discovered by the Babylonians, and essentially they're very long-term cycles that track the path of an eclipse down through the centuries. And I'm talking 10, 12, 20 centuries.
Wow.
where all Ceres cycles begin with a partial eclipse near the poles, and then down through the centuries they progress closer and closer to the equator, and they become total eclipses or annular eclipses. So this, what we're just now into, is the beginning of an entirely new cycle that's going to go on, I think, until the year 3700. I'm just speaking off the top of my head because I don't remember exactly, but it is mentioned in my forecast.
Yeah, definitely so. And that website, again, is AstroPro. It's www.astropro.com.
Yes.
That's A-S-T-R-O-P-R-O.
Thank you.
And I definitely would encourage people to go to that. Now, a couple of things that come to me out of this discussion, particularly of the moon, is that, of course, the moon causes tides. The you know, our mutual attraction, we have mm-hmm. the moon attracted to the Earth, and then the Earth being attracted to the moon and showing up as tide. Now, if you're talking about the moon coming really close and moving fast, and that seismic events happen, I'm put to mind of the Earth's core, which is liquid and molten. Could that be affected as a tide sort of thing with this proximity of the moon? And the other question is, how is that affected by whether it's a new moon or a full moon?
Essentially, the new moon and the full moon are equal in the geophysical effects, like tides. The difference in human consciousness is huge because we see that full moon, and a supermoon full moon is so big. It's
yes.
11% bigger than a normal full moon. And, of course, everybody has seen how any full moon looks so much bigger when it's near the horizon, near the eastern horizon
yeah.
as the sun sets.
That's what people say.
These
look at
things
that.
Are huge.
Yeah. They are. I mean, I was watching it. We weren't able to always see it because it was, you know, winter, rainy, things
yeah.
of that nature. But there was a certain period of time, a window of a few hours, when it was very visible, and it was really quite an amazing sight.
And there are other peculiar things that I've been following now for a number of years that I'm not sure how they tie into solar and lunar phenomena, because I can't rule out that they, you know, they might. But there is an unusual configuration of the planets Jupiter and Neptune and Saturn, which occurs, well, like, for example, it was in effect in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
The last time that it happened under this particular combination, basically it's Neptune and Aquarius opposing Saturn and Leo with Jupiter squaring from Scorpio. This happened in 2006. It last happened before that in 536, which
wow.
was, that was the basically, it was the end of the Roman Empire. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, historians can argue, but the last Roman emperor sat on the throne when this one was going on. And before that, it was, oh my goodness, so far back. It was the end of a climate cycle that was global. And let me see here. It was 536. Okay, the last one prior to that was 37, 34, BCE, and that was at the end of the Neolithic subpluvial climate epoch, also known as the Holocene wet phase, and that's when desertification took over
right.
In North Africa. And you know, the effects were global, different in different regions. They had a freeze in the Andes and the desert advancing in the Sahara, as I mentioned. There was a drought in Great Britain. Of course, it wasn't Great Britain then.
Right.
And there were floods in Mesopotamia. So these things coincide with huge climate change. And the fall of Justinian in the Eastern Roman Empire, that was also connected with big climate change.
Really?
Well, we're into the third one of these since the year 3734 BCE. And it's kind of like a long-lasting thing, and 2006 was when I think people started noticing, 2005, 2006, right in that time period.
Wow, wow. Well, that is real, and those are planets in our
yes,
solar system.
And that's the thing. I say, you know, they're different, of course, from the sun and moon, but these cycles of the planets, particularly the majors, and the statistical work that was done by Theodor Landscheid, a German Supreme Court judge, was also an astrologer, and he did a lot of work on climatology before his death. And he showed that Jupiter and Neptune in particular had an effect on, it's a cycle in the solar revolution around the center of mass of the solar system. It gets kind of complicated, but everybody thinks, well, the sun is the center of the solar system. No.
No?
The center of the solar system is a point that's outside the sun, although sometimes it's actually inside the sun, but usually it's near the surface of the sun. So as this point moves in and out from the surface of the sun, there are changes in climate, and this point moves according to the planets Jupiter and Neptune, as Landscheid found.
Wow. That's amazing. So just as the moon, here's the analogy I'm going to make. The moon orbits the Earth and causes tides. So there's a pull against the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm hearing you correctly with this, that the major planets, which is, like, the Earth isn't really a major planet. Jupiter's like many thousand Earths, and you got Neptune out there. So you got your Saturn, you got your bigger planets. When they are forming in a certain arrangement, the sun itself will actually move off of its center. Is that what you're saying?
It's sort of like if you're swinging a bucket around your head, if the bucket's, you know, fuller of water, it takes more force and tends to pull your arm out more.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's lighter, then, you know, it's easier to swing it around close to you because the centripetal force isn't pulling it away. So we can think of these things with analogies from our own experience, but the bottom line, and I don't think anybody has a way of quantifying this yet, astrologers talked about it for millennia, but this solar system is essentially an organism, and everything in it is an organ or a cell. This is only an analogy, but it's so easy for us to think, yeah, here I live in the United States and in my city and there's the freeway and so on. I have no connection with the universe. You can't escape that connection with the universe.
It even is happening inside of you.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, we're all energy, and we're talking about big forces of energy. And in fact, the sun, which is so mighty and so dense, is just doing the best job possible of holding the center, but it is actually being influenced.
Yeah, it's being rocked around by everything around it. And that rocking around coincides, according to Landscheid's research, and, I mean, you can look at it. The solar cycle, everybody talks about the 11-year sunspot cycle. No, it's actually double that. And it's not, 22 years every cycle. It varies. But basically, it's on the cycle approximate to a double Jupiter or a Jupiter-Saturn conjunction.
Mm.
And these things are connected with our climate. Obviously, the Maunder minimum, which was almost a complete lack of sunspots in the 18th century, 17th century, that was the mini ice age.
Yeah. And you know, one thing I want to throw in here is that, you know, we've been talking about things that when you countenance them, they appear like really disastrous things in the making, things to be feared, and definitely things to be realistic about if you're going to put any kind of stock in it at all. Which I'm coming around to that I do, but also that there are some positive things to be looking at, and I'm going to throw in something about just a little nod to Carolyn Casey, the visionary activist who talks about astrological phenomena a lot on her show. But one of the things that she has thrown out there is that there's a squaring of Jupiter and I think Saturn. I don't know if Mars is in there. But that there is potential for dark forces, but there's also these connections to creativity and, you know, all these great positive things. And I couldn't really, you know, outline it brilliantly, but does that ring true anywhere in what you're looking at here with the squaring of the planets?
Well, let me see now. Jupiter is right now closer to the opposition to Saturn, but it has been... let me see. One of the things I would point out, and I've always mentioned this to my clients, we tend to, in astrology, look upon squares as problematical.
Yeah.
And I would say, as a sailor, and that was another thing that helped me discover the supermoon, as a sailor, I would much rather try to come in or out of port with the moon full or new, in other words, conjunction or opposition, than when it's square, when you got a quarter moon. And the reason is that the conjunction and opposition, those alignments are the real power things, and everything else, it just pales in significance. And when you've got a newer full moon, the tide is very high, so you can sail in and you're not going to hit any rocks. You don't have to worry so much about the channel.
Good
when
analogy.
The moon is quarter, which is when it's square, the water doesn't rise as high. There's rocks that you can hit. So you have to be much more conscious and aware and much more acutely attuned to changing direction under squares than with conjunctions or oppositions. And I think that's the key to these squares is it's not challenge so much as it is an opportunity to avoid disaster, to prosper, to get where you want to go.
Great.
But you can't sit back and let the thing go on autopilot.
Yeah, that's where it's going to shift right under your feet as an
earthquake. Yeah.
And that's another area I want to go to here with this too is when we're talking about, you know, there's these things to be aware of, be aware that there are some massive changes coming in activity with these, with maybe there's a supermoon, maybe there's an eclipse. In particular, those are the ones I notice in your predictions, although you do have a lot of information there. So on the positive side, there's also positive advice you offer with these as a really hardworking and you know astrologer who's you know a professional and serving the client. You're fine looking for the opportunities and the positives. So I'm curious with respect to when we have these eclipses coming and we have supermoons coming, what are the positives? You've mentioned something with the tides and it can be beneficial. Any other areas like that?
Well, let me see. What did I say? Well, I'm always going to expect an increase in storms, which is obviously going to mean rainfall. I would like to plant my crops close to a new or a full moon. I know the old astrologers will always say new moon. Okay, fine. but still, the idea is you're going to get more rain. And if I had to choose between the two and it was crops that I was trying to grow, I would probably take the new moon. And maybe in particular a day or two after it when the first crescent appears, which is holy in umpteen religions for the reason that you know the growth cycle has begun. And, I mean, yes, I would try to avoid long trips, whether by air or even by car, because of weather interruptions. And I'm always getting email from clients, thank you for telling me about that storm. My wife didn't listen, and now she's stuck.
Yeah, that's an aspect that you add to the astrology that I haven't seen in a lot of places and is quite very practical and refreshing.
Well, thank you. I try to do a good job.
Now, one of the things where you were talking about some of the like Mars and you had between the supermoon and the next eclipse earlier in the year, like between March and June, that you were also predicting social unrest. And then, of course, the Middle East spring, you know, really hit hard and became a wave across the Middle East. But there were some things that you were saying about that this social unrest, that there's going to be a shifting and transformation and be looking at it as opportunities for transformation, like as a person, as a humanity.
Yeah, and the underlying theme, astrologically speaking, sort of bringing all this out is a Saturn-Uranus opposition has been going on for some years now. And that in itself talks about a change in social structure. Go back to the French Revolution. It was volcanic eruptions led to crop failures, led to let them eat cake because they don't have bread, led to off with their head. These things are connected and sort of maybe in a distant chain, but it's there with climate change, with volcanic eruptions, and with social breakdown or revolution or transformation. And when Mars aspects come up, strong Mars alignments, like, for example, they did in January and February, you get outright revolt. I think one of the courtiers had when the king asked in France, what is that, a revolt out there in the street? And he said, no, sire, it's actually a revolution. You know, and it's come to the point now where these are beyond revolts, they're revolutions. And we like to think in the Western world that, oh, that's very far away. That's in Africa and all those third world countries in the Middle East. And, you know, there's nothing but crazies over there. My goodness, people, it's in downtown London, downtown Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
It's outside the State House in Wisconsin.
Right.
These things are happening right here. We just tend to like to believe, thanks to the media, I think, that, well, this is a crisis far away.
Yeah.
No, it's a crisis in our house, in our street, in our city.
Right. And it doesn't amount to much.
Well, right. They like to think it doesn't amount to much.
Right.
It's like when six years ago when I wrote about what this what was coming for 2006, I said, well, you know, they used to call these things crashes in the 1890s. And then they said, no, that's too scary. And then they would call it, they decided in the 30s, so we're going to call it a depression, because that, you know, that just sounds like a little dip in the road. It's not like falling off a cliff, like a crash. And after the depression they had turned into the Great Depression, they decided, well, we can't use that term for an economic downturn anymore. We have to find something else. So they started calling them recessions. And now they've called this one the Great Recession, just like they called
right.
the, you know, Great Depression. Well, a rose is a rose is a rose. And here we are.
Except that roses smell good.
Yeah, except roses smell good. And, you know, people talk about how, well, in the Great Depression, it's sort of like the analogy between Fukushima and Japan and then the whole world. Well, in the Great Depression, they said, don't worry, there's only 20% unemployment. That means that 80% of the people still have jobs.
Right.
Well, if 80% of the people are working and 20% can't buy anything, then those people who are working aren't working as much. They're not making as much. Things are bad.
Yeah.
So you can have 80% of the people doing okay, as in Japan, you know, when the earthquake and tsunami hit. But that can still drag the whole planet down because we're all connected.
Right. Right, and that's a piece of it. And before I if I can have a couple more minutes with you before
yeah.
I, you know, let you go on your way. We're talking, by the way, to Richard Nolly, who is a professional astrologer, and he has his host of the website www.astropro.com, and we've been talking to him about planetary alignments. And we have some planetary alignments that are predicted for the next year. Okay, and this is where, you know. But I think I warned you a little bit that I would want to like go here a little bit. That in particular, what I'm curious about, and in your opinion, is according to the Maya calendar, that the center of the galaxy will be aligned with the sun and the earth. And I'm not absolutely sure of how the alignment works. I think it's going to be a project of mine here before the end of this year to know more about it. But that the idea is that there is something really extra, I mean, like in addition, additionally powerful, like beyond having an eclipse and beyond having a supermoon in potential, that even it's possible that the poles of the magnetic poles of the Earth will reverse. Now that's a picture with a lot of toppling dominoes, but really I'm just curious about do you see it that way, or as there will be an alignment of some kind of a unique manner, and as we get closer to around that period. Is there anything from your studies that shows that the kinds of phenomena we're seeing will increase, or that it'll at least become a planet where we better keep our eyes open in order to make sure that we're ready for whatever comes?
Well, I wrote a long time ago in my forecast, I think it was 06 or 05, that we are into a period of transition that began in roughly 1980 and finally comes to an end in 2020. So things don't get what we would think of as normal again until 2020. We're still in some cycles that I deal with, which are quite different from anything the Mayans did, that point to extremes of climate and geological activity, temporary extremes of these things, at least through 2014, 15, 16, right around there. So certainly they are there in 2012, and there's a Jupiter-Saturn opposition coming back then that's very important in that regard in terms of social change and climate change and geological activity. In terms of the pole shift, well, we know from the geological record that these things happen and have happened many times before. And I think that that's one point worth emphasizing, is all of this has happened before. The Mayans talked about cycles where the end of one thing is the beginning of the next cycle. Mm-hmm. So it's not like, you know, we fall off a cliff and there is no more. This is a rhythmic in-breathing and out-breathing. I'm confident we're going to get through it. The notion, for example, of the Earth aligning with galactic center.
Yeah.
Well, I got to tell you, that happens every December 21st, roughly.
Okay.
It's part of the Earth's annual cycle around the sun, and the closest alignment is still hundreds of years away. So, those who are pointing to this galactic alignment deal and connecting that to the Mayan cycle idea, they're off. And that's an astronomical fact, but as I say, most astrologers don't do much more than traditional astrology, and so they can, you know, get carried away with this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Right, and you've done a thorough study of the planet, the behavior of planets themselves. It's really clear in how you're describing these movements and oppositions.
Well, I do try.
you didn't know that? Well, I'm here to tell you that's definitely the impression I'm getting.
you are
very welcome. And, you know, definitely so. I wanted to get some of your views. And one of the things that I'm definitely in alignment with the view that no matter what happens as we approach the end of December 2012, that there will be plenty of things occurring before then. Based on just what's predictable so far, and it's definitely underwritten by many of the things that you've been describing, Richard Nolly, of our of the alignment of planets and the in various places in the cosmos. And it's really, you know, this is the first time I've ever interviewed an astrologer to talk about environmental and social issues of this kind and of such an immediate experience. So I definitely appreciate you for bringing that into the conversation.
Well, thank you. This is what in astrology since before Ptolemy's time has been referred to as mundane astrology. The term comes from the Latin mundus, meaning world. And there is an astrology and has long been an astrology, and I would argue began as an astrology that dealt with the world at large and only later was brought down and focused on individuals. This whole idea of social, political, climate change, that was the original astrology of the Babylonians.
Yes, that's right. And it has many iterations throughout history, too.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. Well, I appreciate you, and I doubly appreciate the time that you've given to this interview. Again, it's Richard Nolly, who hosts the website www.astropro.com. Also has a site giving predictions for the year 2011. That's also at the astropro.com site. These are things that you put a lot of these. I mean, it's probably a rich treasure trove of things once you go for the membership. What I've seen so far of what you reveal and share to the world is quite a bit, many, many pages worth of information just right there on the site. So I encourage checking it out, and we are definitely appreciative of your time with us here on Shift Shapers.
Thank you so much, Daniel. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
And have a great rest of the year, okay?
Thank you, sir. You too.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.